From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
This is becoming violent. There is pushing and shoving going on inside this arena. People are throwing objects, supporters, protesters, media. It was simply rocking back and forth.
This week, after violent clashes between supporters and protesters forced the cancellation of a Trump rally in Chicago, the GOP frontrunner's delegate lead continued to grow, and the media continued to wonder, who are the people supporting him?
We saw a Confederate battle flag poster at another Trump rally.
It's a question, a curiosity, that's long been dogging coverage.
The mainstream media attacking the Donald and anyone who votes for him, like the New York Daily News picturing Trump as a clown and calling his supporters mindless zombies.
Close to 20% of voters who support Donald Trump don't support the Emancipation Proclamation. They think Abraham Lincoln's decision to free enslaved Africans during the Civil War was the wrong thing to do.
So are they a mob of ignorant racists? No.
One of the things fueling Trump's support is a feeling by a lot of white working class Americans that things have changed too fast. They don't recognize this country anymore.
So they're the disaffected working class squeezed out of the economy by globalism and increasingly marginalized by an influx of non-white immigrants. Wait, no.
Almost everyone we've talked to who switched over, who crossed over, they said Trump, they want to change. They're tired of politics as usual, Brian.
All right, Tony, something tells me you're on top of a big story there.
So they're an astute political cohort that has run out of patience with a political class tainted by money, biased toward privilege, and welded to the status quo. Or all of the above. Or none of the above. The political media have spent months trying to suss out the Trump insurgency. The Atlantic's James Fallows has not only crossed the country, but also sifted forensically through email and the ever-changing media narrative, seeking an answer.
On Monday of a certain week, the dominant tone will be that the Trump supporters are all big racists. And on Wednesday, it'll be, no, they're not racist. They're actually the dispossessed and squeezed out. And on Thursday evening, it'll be, well, actually, they're pretty racist. And on Saturday, it'll be something else again. And I think that reflects both the way in which contrarianism to whatever is the belief dominates our business, but also the fact that this appears to be a genuinely complex and contradictory movement. And our political press is not ideally suited for conveying complexity.
One of the methods that the press seems to have employed to take the pulse of the Trump base is to read their T-shirts and ball caps. You've taken the odd approach of actually being in communication with some of his supporters to, you know, try to get a little more nuanced view. What's your experience been?
Over the years, I've valued the Atlantic site getting a lot of mail from our readers. And it's been interesting to publish some of the range of material that's come back about Trump. Some of it has been just completely vile. Some of it is from people saying, you poobahs in the media, you have no idea what's going on in the real America. I don't fall over for that criticism as much as some other people might, just because I've spent the last couple of years in the actual rest of the country interviewing people about their situations. But then there's also a sympathetic criticism from people who are not Trump supporters. They say they can understand where he came from. They can understand why his criticisms have landed with such force. And they wonder where this is all going to go.
Were there surprises there for you, you know, that didn't fall into the obvious categories that the press has identified till now?
The one that was surprising, I think, is from people who I would view as otherwise, quote, normal, unquote. That is, I'm thinking of a longtime Army officer, a guy, an American living in Switzerland, some guy in New York, a woman in Seattle, another woman in Kansas, who have written saying they normally vote either Democratic or sort of mainstream Republican, but they just are so fed up that they think the apple cart needs to be overturned in some way. I don't know whether these are people who might have voted for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, but their theme has been, even though they're not normally creatures of the extreme, they, number one, like Trump's brashness, and number two, are not that afraid of what he would actually do in office.
Do you have any other theories that you've been exchanging with your correspondents?
Yes. My other theory is that the main media narrative about the Trump movement and what it represents is that it says something about the movement, that we're seeing something about racial tensions and economic exclusion and impatience with politics by the vehemence of the support for Trump. I think that is partly so, but what is mainly so is that this is mainly about Trump himself. That were it not for the unique kind of performance skills and background and whatever psychological disposition he has, the same objective tensions within the society would not have expressed themselves the way that they have with Trump.
So with that as the context, how in the world would you advise your colleagues to approach these questions of the Trump base? What sort of reporting would you encourage, and where would you say just don't spin your wheels?
I guess the negative advice would be it's just too easy to go to these rallies and find some crazy person there. In a country of 300 million people plus, there are always going to be a couple million nuts. And if you're going to look for somebody with a bad T-shirt or looking like a modern Klansman or whatever, you're going to find that person. Instead, to try to, as best we can, recognize, number one, that this is a complicated, fast-moving situation we aren't going to understand in real time. Number two, to draw out as much as we can, what are the economic realities, who's been displaced and who has not? What are the racial dimensions here? Where do we see support for Trump and not? And just try to do as much explanatory work on the hydraulics of America 2016. Less rally coverage, more talking about the country that is making the decision and the person about whom they are choosing.
To me, the most shocking piece of journalism I've seen that addressed the Trump followers was not where you would have expected it to show up. It wasn't in some bastion of the elitist liberal media. It was in the National Review. And it dismissed the Trump base in terms that I would have called starkly racist and very familiar, except for the fact that they were talking about working-class white Americans, that they have sucked on the teat of society and gotten nowhere except OxyContin addicted. They deserve their fate, and we should just let them go because they're human effluvia. Wow.
Wow, indeed. If there's anything that's going to signal the fracture of the Republican Party as we've known it for the last 150 years, it would be that piece by Kevin Williamson in National Review, because the tone of just withering dismissal of an inferior subhuman group in that article, to have it applied by a conservative organ to working class whites, shows that the alliance of the modern Republican Party between essentially economic royalists, if you will, in Franklin Roosevelt's term, and the culturally conservative who are having religious or racial resentments of one kind or another, this was a sign of fracturing that alliance.
And it might also prove that the central gripe of the Trump base of being disdained and dismissed and uncounted by the political elites of both parties is true.
Yes, America has always been both egalitarian and snobbish, and this was an actually, to me, shocking manifestation of somebody being willing to express this form of looking down on the poor whites slash white trash losers of America. And if you were saying Trump expresses the views of those who feel the object of that scorn, then that would be true.
Jim, as always, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic.
In his piece for the National Review, Kevin Williamson calls poor white America the scene of negligence and incomprehensible malice, that, quote, the truth about these dysfunctional downscale communities is that they deserve to die. And he refers to, quote, family anarchy, which is to say, the whelping of human children with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog. Savage, but to Nancy Heisenberg, not shocking.
That is a really, really old insult. The poor were often compared to curs or a mongrel dog, and these were seen as an inferior breed. You know, they usually would compare the cur to the hound. So a hound is a legitimate dog that works. A cur isn't.
Eisenberg is the author of the upcoming book, White Trash, the 400-year untold story of class in America. She says that the contempt for the poor found in the National Review can be traced back to the foundation of America when the British, who called the poor waste people, saw the New World not as a land of religious liberty, but as an ideal dumping ground.
For the British, there were four ways you could deal with the poor. You hope that maybe they would die from starvation or disease. Maybe they would commit a crime and they would be thrown into prison. The other option was that you would drum them into service. They would be sent off to fight. Soldiers were also referred to as waste. And then the final way was that they would be sent to the colonies, outposts that needed people. But whether they survived or not was a secondary concern.
But there was a revolution, and the Founding Fathers aimed to do away with hierarchy and aristocracy and replace it with liberty and justice for all. In your book, you look at this through the lens of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. But Franklin was not at all sympathetic to the plight of the poor when he developed the Pennsylvania Hospital in 1751. The perpetually impoverished weren't welcome there.
Yeah, and this was also a very classic pattern that existed in Great Britain. You would distinguish the poor who can be helped, those who can be put back into the workforce, and then others who he again sort of assumed were expendable, that there's no need to waste money or effort trying to rehabilitate them.
And Jefferson held two different views in his mind at the same time. He had noble ideas of simple people, hard-working yeoman farmers, but he also referred to the poor as rubbish.
Right. The reason he called them rubbish, he's saying it in the context of calling for how some selected young men from poor families should be given some kind of state-supported education. They would be raked from the rubbish. That phrase already assumes that even if you rake a few, there's still going to be a pile of rubbish left.
And then you have the westward expansion in the 19th century and some new slang, notably squatter and cracker.
Squatter referred to them squatting down, sitting on land that they didn't own. And that is the exact opposite of the British notion of standing. And standing is the legal principle that defines one's territorial right to the land. So they're squatters because they're thieves. Jefferson referred to them as trespassers on the public lands. And the word cracker, this comes from the English idea of cracking a jest, cracking wind. Also, there was the term louse cracker. A louse cracker was a lice-ridden, slovenly, nasty fellow, and that's true by 1720. But it also takes us back to our favorite concept of idleness, because another important connection is that it was drawn from the idea of crack-brained, which denoted not only a crazy person, but it was the English slang for a fool or an idle head.
Even if squatters weren't particularly respected or trusted, they had to be pandered to every few years in order to get people elected. And you mentioned the story of the Arkansas Traveler from 1840.
Yeah, the Arkansas Traveler tells the story of a rich politician canvassing in the backcountry, and he asks a squatter for some refreshment. The squatter is seated on a whiskey barrel, and he ignores him. And the politician is obliged, in order to get his refreshment, in order to get his vote, to, you know, jump off his horse, grab the squatter's fiddle, and show that he can play his kind of music. And that, I think, really is a recurrent problem with our American democracy. What we really have is a democracy of manners, not a real democracy. And what I mean by that is that we accept huge disparities in wealth, but we demand that our politicians sound like us or dress like us.
Eat our corn dogs.
Right. And it's all a performance. This is actually one of the things that I see Trump doing. The key to his appeal is the way he talks. You know, he's blunt, he's offensive, and his supporters view that as raw honesty. Even though he comes from a pampered life of wealth and privilege, every time he opens his mouth, he affirms his allegiance to the working poor. That's what they like about him.
You know, at this point, we should address the fact that yours is explicitly a history of the white lower class. You don't suggest that there wasn't fierce and violent racism in both the lower and the upper classes, or that the treatment of poor whites, however horrible, was anywhere near as bad as those who were enslaved or racially discriminated against.
Race is a very important category of my book. I talk about how prominent Southern politicians, particularly at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, are seen as inciting poor white racism, supporting lynching. But one of the things that I think most people would find really surprising is that the Southern planter elite, before the Civil War, valued their slaves more than they valued white trash, because slaves were at least productive.
And actually, the phrase white trash emerges around the time of the Civil War, right?
Yes, because it's part of the language that is adopted by the Republican Party when they critique the South and the slave economy. This is when they begin to see the poor white trash as this dangerous offshoot. They see their children as old before their time, shriveled. They are described as a curious species. And they ask this question, are these really Americans? How could America have produced such people? They are seen as dangerous, a group that by the eugenics period, it's not enough to just assume that we can dump them somewhere. Now you have to make sure that they can't reproduce.
There is one point in our history, you note, when there was active intervention to actually improve the lives of the poor. You had FDR's New Deal, though it was largely aimed at the white population.
Suddenly, 20% of the population is out of work. You can't just blame one group for being an inferior breed, or you can't just blame them for somehow being lazy and idle, because now a large portion of the population find themselves shorn of their ability to be productive members of society. Suddenly people are willing to listen and think about the poor and look at them in a very different way. And this is one of the things that, you know, James Agee captured so beautifully when he argued that to understand the poor, we have to understand that we, the middle of the elite class, who shame them, have contributed to the problems that they face.
In the years of civil rights legislation, school desegregation, your book goes into detail about how the rest of the U.S. thought of poor whites who were protesting such progress as bigots, as inbred, and so on. Many of them back in the 60s were racist, and certainly some Trump supporters are today, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a conundrum. They do subscribe to certain views that are undoubtedly racist, and you can't mask it and pretend that it's not there. It is very much a part of their thinking. But the other problem is when people want to blame poor whites for being the only racist in the room, as if they're more racist than everyone else. Again, it reinforces the whole cycle again, that they don't deserve to be a part of civil society because their ideas are so backward.
Whereas many people have said, basically, Trump has put down the dog whistle and said things in plain English that have been said for years and years in politer language. And this brings us back around. Does the media's treatment of these people and the assumptions the media make reflect what you've seen play out over the last 400 years when discussing the white working class?
But the problem is our media is just too dismissive and everything's reduced to a soundbite. When you refer to people as just being angry, it's another insult. When Jefferson used it, he was referring to someone who's primitive and is so angry they can't speak. And it's that same idea that they're not advanced enough to understand their interests. We have to begin to pay attention to class because people are shocked when invisible people begin to speak. They say, where did this come from? How can this happen in America? How can this explain the way we imagine the myth of social mobility? So all we tend to get from the media is usually shock, and then it recedes into the background again and no one talks about it.
What do we gain by directly addressing class issues, and what do we lose by denying them?
We have to talk about class because it essentially defines people in the most fundamental ways. You are born into a class station. You get privileges from your family, privileges from where you live. It is the essence of who we are. The most troubling thing people don't want to accept is that there are large numbers of Americans who do not experience social mobility. And it's not just because they're inept or they're lazy or they're stupid. I mean, we only had a real middle class in this country because of all the New Deal legislation, because of the loans given to housing, because of the growth of the economy. So it requires us to admit that we are in some way responsible for the existence of poverty. And that's what we don't want to admit.
Nancy, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Nancy Eisenberg is the T. Harry Williams Professor at Louisiana State University and author of White Trash, the 400-Year Untold History of Class in America, which will be out in June.
Coming up, don't worry about money in politics. Turns out most of it is wasted.
This is On the Media. Hey, podcast listeners. This time, I am not asking you for money. We're hoping to learn more about what you want to hear and how you listen to shows from WNYC Studios. Please tell us. Please, please, please. Go to wnyc.org/participate and take the brief survey. wnyc.org/participate. It could actually have an impact. Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. According to the advertising analysis group SMG Delta, by the time Florida Senator Marco Rubio dropped out of the presidential race this week, $55 million had been spent on TV ads in support of his campaign. And yet he couldn't even win his home state on Tuesday. In this, he treads the path of this year's other big spending losers, Scott Walker, and of course, Jeb Bush, whose campaign and super PAC spent a total of $82 million on TV ads and quit with zero primary wins to his name. Another week, another example of the counterintuitive way money and advertising is working, or not working. Or maybe it's working exactly like it's supposed to not work. It's part of what Andrew Coburn in the April Harper's Magazine calls the election industrial complex, in which campaign spending is designed less to elect the candidate than to enrich the campaign consultant class. Mainly, Coburn notes, such spending is accomplished through buying TV ads, which are generally stunningly lame and don't work.
Because they're actually very hokey. They look like what they are, which is slapped together in a day or so in some sort of small studio and flung on the air.
The political class and their pundit buddies say, impossible. He's too outside the box.
People really like that. During the next few weeks, you'll be seeing a lot of commercials from us.
When I became governor, state government needed to be cut, just like my lawn. So I got to work.
One of the things in your article that really struck me is that your gut-level instinct that they couldn't possibly work was borne out.
That's right. It's very intensively studied. The effect at most is entirely ephemeral. You see an ad on Monday saying so-and-so is going to make the universe great again. On Tuesday, you're asked by a pollster, what do you think of so-and-so? And you think, oh, he's going to make the universe great again. And you say, I'm for him. And on Wednesday, you've entirely forgotten. The whole effect of that ad has gone away. So these enormous quantities of dollars that are poured into this are almost entirely wasted. I say almost because there are a few narrow spots where perhaps they are worth spending money on. One is when you've got a complete unknown. And the other is at the very last minute, if the election's on the Tuesday, if you dump ads on people's eyeballs on Monday, it may have an effect.
So what does work?
the ground game or field operations. That's the sort of fancy professional name for it. But it's basically going around and talking to people and not just ringing the bell saying, hi, you're voting for Brooke, thank you very much, goodbye. It's been shown that if you engage people and actually talk to them, the longer the better, turnout shoots up.
How do consultants make money off of ads that they don't make off of a ground game?
Ah, this is the big secret of the election industrial complex. The way it works is this. Brooke Gladstone is running for higher office, okay? I'm the consultant, and I say, Brooke, we need to do a big buy in the northern part of the state. It's going to cost $1 million. So the campaign treasurer and I book time on various TV stations, and the stations send me my commission for having brought them the business. In the old days, this was a standard 15%.
Wow.
You know, no one noticed, I should say, because they were just writing a check for $1 million and they were told they'd bought $1 million out of ads. And the consultants didn't go out of their way to explain that 15% of that was coming back into their pocket. Then people got a bit wiser and said, well, no, 15%, we're not paying you that. How about 5, 6% and so forth? The consultants accepted that. Although I've been told, I couldn't document this, there are all sorts of underhanded ways, unbeknownst to the campaign, where you can jack that up, go as high as 30% even today.
Election industrial complex, it's a takeoff on military industrial complex.
And you see it very clearly, you know, in the defense case, you know, when money gets pumped into a weapon which fails every test visible to all concerned but carries on. When 80% or so of the money in the election industrial complex case gets pumped into something that's self-evidently almost ineffective, but enormously profitable for the people who are managing the effort, it's the same thing. You have to think about what the campaign is for. Is it to find the most efficient way of getting the favored candidate elected? Or is it to put money, the more the better, in the pockets of the consultants he has retained to advance his cause? The primary function of the election industrial complex is to look after number one, itself.
But what about the ground game? Is there some inherent resistance to the ground game other than the fact that the consultants don't make a percentage on it?
There's a couple of objections, including the one you just mentioned. There's no real money in it. It's kind of hard work. You have to start very early. You have to recruit volunteers. But there's another problem, too, which is the people that you need to do this are, by definition, pretty committed, the people who go around door to door or make all those phone calls. So they're liable to feel a bit more strongly about issues than you do. That can be kind of awkward. You want to keep control of the message. If you suddenly have to depend on people who have a slightly different view and a more extreme view of what needs to be done than you, you're building up a problem for yourself. So I think there's an instinctive reaction in the machine against going too far.
Volunteers are wild cards?
They're wild cards. You know, they all, I defy you to find a candidate or a campaign manager who won't tell you, yeah, the ground game, that's where it's at. You know, we're really putting a huge amount of resources into our field operations. That's the key. And then you look at what they spent their money on. It all turns out to be TV all over again.
Let's talk about the other aspects of this. With the rise of the super PACs, you've got Mr. and Mrs. Billionaire with their vanity candidates. These people weren't all that big on oversight, right? And plus, super PACs don't get any.
Right. As one consultant said to me, I love super PACs. He says, like living under the golden arches. No need to talk to the candidate, no need to talk to the staff, no need to talk to the voters. Just put up a bunch of TV ads and sit back and let the money roll in. Because there's this wonderful legal stipulation about super PACs is that the campaigns aren't allowed to contact them. The 1% or the 1% of 1% or whatever it is, they don't know. It's not their business. They happen to hear about TV commissions, for instance. I can say, well, that's a standard deal, you know. Of course, this is the way the business operates. Everyone does this 15% or, pushing it a bit, 25%. Yes, thank you, Mr. Billionaire. You know, so the consultant class loves super PACs for just this reason.
Okay, so let's not leave out the media, especially the broadcasters who, in these troubled times, may actually count on campaign spending to keep their stations afloat in the lean years. Do we spy a potential conflict of interest?
I think one hits a smack dab on the nose. When I talk about the election industrial complex, I definitely include the broadcast industry, because that $7 or $8 billion, maybe more, that this election is going to cost, the largest chunk of that will go straight into the pockets of the broadcasters, which is why the broadcasters heartily endorse the whole notion of big money politics and, you know, excessive spending.
Well, they don't necessarily endorse it, but I certainly haven't heard reported in any detail about how ineffective television ads are.
You don't hear that, do you? I can't think why not. But when you say they don't endorse it, I mean, they do off camera, so to speak. Les Moonves, the boss of CBS, in 2012, he said, super PACs may be bad for the country, but they're certainly good for CBS. This year, he said, the more they spend, the better it is for us. Go, Donald.
But it's interesting, because Donald Trump has spent relatively little on his campaign. Only recently has he spent much at all on campaign ads. How does Trump figure into the election industrial complex?
Oh, I think if he hadn't been there, they would have wanted to invent him. He's been wonderful for them. He's in a fantastic ratings draw. That's point one. And point two is, of course, all these stop Trumpers are dashing to express themselves in the only way they know how, which is by spending millions of dollars on TV ads denouncing him.
With cash-rich candidates like Jeb Bush failing so spectacularly, are the donors and campaigns finally going to wise up?
You'd think, but that's what one could have said after 2012. In fact, Karl Rove raised all these hundreds of millions of dollars, and of the people he was trying to get elected, he succeeded once. I mean, one congressman. In fact, the donors were so annoyed, one of them even tried to sue him for fraud. So everyone thought, well, maybe people will wise up. But, you know, this time we got more money than ever pouring in. It's drilled into all of us that elections come at a high price. There's no way around it. You've got to buy scads and scads of TV time and shower the American people with mail in hopes of just getting them to stagger out to the poll and maybe put a cross against your name.
Last week you tweeted, Andrew, liberals shouldn't fret about big money controlling elections. The consultants swipe it. Is that the lesson?
I think it is. One of the reasons I wrote this thing was I was getting tired of, you know, people mobilizing to defeat Citizens United and that the problem is the money, which implicitly accepts that money wins. As I tried to explain in this piece, you know, money doesn't win.
So then the real lesson is, if voters want to fix the system, then they actually just have to
be involved. The money is, in a way, designed to shut you out. So, yeah, it would be a major effect.
Andrew, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Andrew Coburn is Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. His piece, Down the Tube, Television Turnout and the Election Industrial Complex, is in the April issue of Harper's.
Coming up, China's latest crackdown on free expression, and why not? The state-owned press says the rise of Trump proves democracy doesn't work.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Great Firewall of China, the digital fortress aimed at keeping out the marauding forces of uncensored news, information, entertainment, and literature, is being reinforced. Already heavily censored, the country's three largest news organizations got a visit last month from President Xi Jinping, just to remind them, you know, where their loyalties must lie.
They are there to serve the interests of the Communist Party.
The media should be first and foremost a Communist Party mouthpiece.
He told executives that the media must protect the party's authority.
It's their party, and they'll decry if they want to. Decry Western influence, decry anti-revolutionary sentiment, decry criticism. Meanwhile, new laws have been put into place prohibiting foreign publishers from loading any content onto Chinese servers without government approval. Lockman Soy is assistant professor of journalism at the Chinese University of Hong Kong and former head of free expression for Google's Asia and Pacific regions. Lockman, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me here, Bob.
Let's start with the March 10th development, the law that blocks foreign companies from publishing any content online of, quote, informational or thoughtful nature without prior approval from the government. That could cover just about anything.
That is sort of the point. And it's not that it's ever been specific in the law. They already have really broad categories for the kind of content that is not permitted. When Google decided to move its search engine outside of China, it was at that point Google versus China. That was in 2010. And since then, you know, Facebook is not there, Twitter is not there, YouTube is not there, Dropbox is not there. You know, it's no longer Google versus China. It's now pretty much the internet versus China, right? It's not like, you know, this law suddenly changes what's going on in China. It's really just codifying what's already going on. The big idea that Xi has been pushing is this idea called internet sovereignty. It's a fancy word for being able to justify that, hey, I have the right to control the internet inside my country.
The new laws affect foreign media outlets, but the most glaring impact is on domestic media, now explicitly expected to promote the government and the party. I want to play some tape from a video that was published at the order of President Xi to put a positive spin on his latest five-year plan. And here's a bonus. It's in English.
Hey, have you guys heard what's going on in China?
President Xi Jinping's new style?
Yes, and there's more.
The Shisanwu.
The what?
China's 13th five-year plan. Yeah, the Shisanwu.
Oh.
Every 5 years in China, man, they make a new development plan. Time has come for number 13. Shisanwu, that's what it means. As the plan goes down from high to low, the government's experience continues to grow. They have to work hard and deliberate, because a billion lives are all at stake.
Like every job. Chen Sun Li Zhou.
When the public sees this kind of cheesy propaganda, do they roll their eyes?
People might have opinions about it, but they won't air it. And then, so it's the classic sort of spiral of silence theory from Neumann, explaining how the Second World War could happen in Germany back then. If you have an opinion, but you think the majority doesn't share that opinion, you won't voice it, right? And hence the spiral of silence. Sometimes you see when the crackdown is intensifying, you've seen a couple of people within the government speaking up saying, hey, this might not be a good thing. You know, shouldn't the media also serve the public? That's huge. You do see sort of these moments where someone says, hey, you know, the emperor doesn't have any clothes on.
Speaking of the emperor, since the death of Mao Zedong, there have been, I don't know, half a dozen leaders of China. None of them, with the possible exception of Zhou Enlai, had a cult of personality built around him. But it looks almost as though Xi is trying to cultivate that very thing. Is that my imagination?
No, it's not your imagination. I think it's absolutely true. You can just look at the difference in media content and campaigns. There was this joke on Twitter. They looked at the front page of the People's Daily. 11 of the articles on the front page were all about Xi, under Hu Jintao and even under Jiang Zemin. The term was, you know, they were the first among equals. That's no longer the case under Xi. Xi is just the first.
There's one other little wrinkle to this crackdown I want to ask you about.
Sure.
Hong Kong bookstore owner just kind of vanished, apparently to the mainland, where it was presumed that he was being held by authorities for some slight, real or imagined, against the party.
There are five of them, actually, at this point, not just one, that are all, if you ask me, being kidnapped to China. They are based in Hong Kong. We have high levels of autonomy, according to the basic law. You know, we allow for free expression here. The books they publish are flies in the ointment kind of stuff, meaning unauthorized biographies of political leaders, undocumented love lives of political leaders, you know, and all that stuff. And so what happened is that, you know, like at some point it disappeared. The wife reports this, says, hey, you know, he's gone. I don't know where he went. This one particular person, Li Bo, was in Hong Kong. There was another person who was in Thailand in his nice fancy resort in Pattaya, I believe. Also, for some mysterious reasons, ended up in China. And so this is not just about Chinese soil and, you know, Chinese territory, right? You know, they're going outside the borders to grab people at this point.
And if you're the Hong Kong political elite, it's all about choosing your battles with the mainland government and party, right? So is this where they draw the line in the sand and defend this guy's rights?
Now, the interesting thing is that they got the people to confess on television. He was forced to be on TV and then said, like, hey, you know, I went back to China to confess a crime I did 13 years ago. I hit someone with my car. And now 13 years later, you know, while I was lounging in my pool in Thailand, I suddenly got a wave of guilt, you know, and I felt compelled to go back and confess my crime. The utility to this public confession is to keep up this charade, you know, that, hey, you know, we are still complying with law. We haven't done nothing wrong because, hey, you know, he's here by himself. We didn't grab him, right? And, hey, you know, the fact that he, you know, has certain rights, you know, he's giving them up voluntarily. Look, you know, he saw himself on television. If you're the Hong Kong authorities, you're put in a very difficult spot, right? You know, what are you going to do?
It has a kind of cultural revolution tinge to it. The forced confessions, the parading of the political criminals for public consumption. China's not heading in that direction, is it?
It's hard to say. I mean, we're getting closer to it for sure, right? And these are the things that happened 50 years ago, exactly.
Let me ask you about your personal stake in all this. I mean, apart from teaching journalism and watching with some dismay as freedoms are rolled back, you have a particular interest in a robust internet culture and the freedom that goes with it. Why?
I grew up in Amsterdam, in Holland, as a son of two parents from Hong Kong. But I always had close ties to my family here and the culture here. I think I was in first year of college. It's, you know, I saw this movie by a Hong Kong film director, Wong Kar-wai, called Chungking Express.
On the streets of Hong Kong, a mysterious woman, a young cop, and an innocent dreamer are about to meet, where mystery and romance collide.
I came out of that film theater thinking, holy crap, you know, this is an amazing movie. I ended up making an unofficial website for the film director, and that way found out that actually a lot of people cared about this movie and, you know, wanted to talk about it. And this is why I feel so strongly about free expression. You know, when we talk about free expression, it's either about finding out about truth with a capital T, right? Or it's important for self-governance. But the third argument for free expression is that it's really important for autonomy. And that's something that resonates with me very deeply. Autonomy being sort of understood as becoming who you are, who you want to be, right? It includes figuring out who you are.
Lachman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Lachman Soy teaches journalism at the Chinese University of Hong Kong.
This week, as Donald Trump won primaries in Florida, North Carolina, and Illinois, he talked about how huge his victories were.
Everybody's writing about it all over Europe. All over the world, they're talking about it.
In this case, Trump's grand assertion was not entirely an exaggeration. In an op-ed published this week by the state-run Global Times, the Chinese government used Trump's rise as an object lesson on the perils of democracy. Quote, Mussolini and Hitler came to power through elections, a heavy lesson for Western democracy. Even if Trump is simply a false alarm, the impact has already left a dent. The U.S. faces the prospect of institutional failure. Simon Denyer is China bureau chief for the Washington Post. Simon, welcome to On the Media.
It's good to be here.
So, I mean, it's not the first time China has taken advantage of American-style mayhem. I remember after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, the government took the opportunity to point out American inferiority and all-around hypocrisy, right?
You're right. I think this is different because they're really crowing about the failure of democracy. And this really plays into one of the Communist Party's big arguments here, that one party communist rule stands for stability and democracy is inherently unstable. So when they see democracy, as they put it, electing somebody who incites violence or somebody who's racist, they can't help telling their people, look at that, look at democracy. You don't really want that, right?
You tried to pick apart basically what was underneath the message, that it wasn't about Trump at all.
That's right. It's about whether democracy is a good system. So first of all, one thing they said is, well, we all know that voting for people doesn't do any good. So why not vent your anger and vote for Trump? The other thing that they said, of course, is that, you know, democracy leads to fistfights, leads to people arguing with each other. I think it's one of the big pillars of Communist Party legitimacy that without the party, China would be unstable. But it's important to realize here that this is something they've really twisted around. They've elided a big part of China's own Communist Party history.
What do you mean? It's been absolutely smooth sailing since Chairman Mao.
Right. Well, let's talk about Chairman Mao for a second. You know, I mean, the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, famine which killed tens of millions of people, an era of absolute chaos, terrible suffering. So one party rule is pretty dangerous when you've got an extremist in charge or someone who's unbalanced. They forget that.
I think we get what the government feels about Trump. Do you have any sense of people across the political spectrum, what kind of take they have on him?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to tell what people really think in China because so much of it is censored and so much of it is filtered through the Communist Party's own system. But people do express their opinions on social media. There are people who are pro-US, who are pro-democracy and freedom of speech, who wouldn't particularly like Trump. You know, the funny thing is that there are a few people in the US, Chinese dissidents, and not just Chinese dissidents, Vietnamese dissidents and Cuban dissidents, and they said there was surprising support for Donald Trump among people like that. The reason was they thought, well, actually, he's strong. He'll stand up to China. He'll stand up to China on a range of things, including perhaps, you know, the way China treats its own citizens. Now, that view has completely changed. They have been disabused of that notion, if you like, in the last week when at the latest Republican debate, Donald Trump talked about the Tiananmen Square protesters as rioters and seemed to be praising China's government for showing a strong hand in putting them down.
You said, quote, they were vicious, they were horrible, but they put it down with strength. That shows you the power of strength.
I was not endorsing it. I said that is a strong, powerful government that put it down with strength, and then they kept down the riot. It was a horrible thing. It doesn't mean at all I was endorsing it.
If some of them were attracted to Trump, none of them are now. They've really changed their view.
And how about the view towards Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, for that matter?
Right. I don't think that many people know much about Bernie Sanders, but they do know Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton has always stuck up for human rights, for women's rights in China. That makes her popular with some people in China. It doesn't make her popular with the government, and it doesn't make her popular with people who follow and believe in government propaganda, which is a large proportion of the population. So there is a strain of thought which was expressed on social media as well. You know, Donald Trump might be scary, but anyone's better than Hillary Clinton.
Boy, that sounds familiar. Simon, thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.
Simon Denyer is China Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. We spoke to him via Skype.
It's not just the Chinese government weighing in on Trump's ascent. The Economist's Global Forecasting Service recently rated a Trump presidency among the top 10 global risks, right up there with the collapse of the European Union and the jihadi terrorist threat. Back in December, the British Parliament considered a measure that would have banned Trump from visiting the UK. Prime Minister David Cameron opposed it, but he also opposed Trump.
I think his remarks are divisive, stupid, and wrong. And I think if he came to visit our country, I think he'd unite us all against him.
Saudi Prince Al-Walid bin Talal tweeted to Trump, "You are a disgrace not only to the GOP, but to all America. Withdraw from the U.S. presidential race, as you will never win." And a German newspaper recently quoted Economic Minister Sigmar Gabriel saying that, quote, right-wing populists like Trump are not only a threat to peace and social cohesion, but also to economic development. And former Mexican President Vicente Fox had this to say about one of Trump's chief campaign promises.
I declare, I'm not going to pay for that wall.
On the question of that wall, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau agreed with Fox, albeit more Canadianly.
Being
open and respectful towards each other is much more powerful as a way to defuse hatred and anger than layering on, you know, big walls and oppressive policies.
But Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa sees an upside to Trump. This week he suggested that while a Trump victory would be bad for the U.S., it could invigorate progressive Latin American leaders. And at least one world leader is unreservedly excited about Trump. Russian President Vladimir Putin.
He is a brilliant and talented person without a doubt, but it is not our right to identify his virtues. It is the prerogative of the U.S. voters.
Another upside. Trump sets the bar so comfortably low, it's easy for even the most bellicose politician to vault. For example, when Trump called for closing U.S. borders to all Muslims, quote, until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on, he was likened to the far-right president of the French National Front, Marine Le Pen, to which she said, seriously, have you ever heard me say something like that? And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tweeted that he rejects Trump's remarks about Muslims. So, we got that going for us.
And that's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Mithali Rao. We had more help from Dasha Luzitsina and David Conrad. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Casey Means and Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.